The San Antonio Spurs are going to the NBA Finals. Tom Abishur and I recorded this right after Game 7, reacted to everything that happened, looked ahead to the Knicks and the Spurs starting next Wednesday in the NBA Finals, also looked ahead to the offseason as well for the Thunder. What are they going to do next? Are they going to trade up in the draft? Are they going to go for Giannis? What's going to happen next? All that coming up now with me and Tom Abishur. Welcome back to the Kevin O'Connor Show. The Spurs are going to the NBA Finals to discuss it with me, Tom Abishur. What's up, Tom?
Wow. I mean, we got Game 7, OKC San Antonio. And I mean, I just feel like we, as basketball fans, we got what we deserved after that regular season. We got those two teams, an amazing Game 7, Wemby versus SGA. And Mike Tirico said it. It's the Wemby era is here. And what a performance from the Spurs.
It's actually here already, Tom. I mean, I thought the Spurs might take another year or another 2 years to catch up with the Thunder. And yet we're here with the San Antonio Spurs going to be facing off against the New York Knicks in the NBA Finals. Wemby tonight, 22 points on 7 of 15. And numerous just Wemby alterations at the rim, just deterring players from getting into the paint, even at the end of the game. Fear in the eyes of the Thunder, particularly Chet Holmgren, who did not want to be there at all, bobbling the ball, tripping over his own feet, passing any opportunity he could get, just playing scared. That's due to Wemby. But ultimately, this Spurs team as a whole, Tom, you talked about it in the middle of the year. This is obviously a Wemby-driven team, but Julian Champagne, 6 of 10 from 3 tonight. De'Aaron Fox stepping up, playing hurt, 15 points in the game. Castle, big buckets in the first half of that game. The Cornette block! The Cornette block in the fourth quarter!
No.
Oh, my God.
You can't call it a Cornette block. It is the Cornette contest. It is the Cornette contest. Yeah. It's up there with block by James. Blocked by Cornette. I mean, it was unbelievable, this chase down block here with two hands against Isaiah Hartenstein.
I mean, what a swing. That would have made it 97-93. And instead, the Spurs go down the other side of the floor, make a shot, and then Wemby comes back into the game. And from there, you know, it slowly but surely became curtains. I'm just amazed, Tom. I'm still collecting my thoughts here as we're streaming right after the final buzzer. Look, I think for the Thunder, in part, no A.J. Mitchell, no Jalen Williams, that certainly helped San Antonio out with the way they were able to defend the Thunder in this series. However, we saw SGA have a magical game, 35 points, 12 of 21, hitting tough shot after tough shot, doing a good job getting into Wemby's body to create space on that mid-range jumper, hit some threes in the game, got to the line, got Vassell out of the air. But the Spurs role players overall just were the big difference in this game. So how many tough shots, clutch shots, timely shots did Julian Champagne hit in this game, Tom? Oh.
Look, man, Kevin, I want you to understand something here. We've been watching this for months now, years, how every year we have a new champion. Over the last 8 seasons, we're going to have 8 champions in the last 8 seasons now that OKC has been dispatched. And I feel like, Kev, we need to understand that playoff experience is dead. It's dead. You look at Alex Caruso airballing it down the stretch, 3 of 14 shooting in this game. And on the other end, play after play after play, Julian Champagne, how many finals appearances, how many playoff appearances he had? Or Dylan Harper with a huge offensive rebounds and putbacks against Alex Caruso with Cason Wallace?
How about the pull-up three he hit with like 90 seconds left or whatever it was? That's a rookie point guard doing that.
It's insane. So we need to recalibrate. How many times in this game and in any broadcast we hear about whenever a veteran makes a big play, they just say, hey, that's experience right there. That's championship experience. But we don't hear about the flip side is, I mean, the fearlessness by these rookies and 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds, Stephon Castle, Victor Wembanyama, Julian Champagne was iced the entire game, was unbelievably hitting those shots from downtown and the big rebounds, the stops. It just feels like there is a new era upon us. Sure, we can talk about Wemby, but I just think that we focus too much about experience. You have to kind of work your way up and lose before you win. But this Spurs team is confirmation. 8 champions over the last 8 years. This Spurs team is confirmation, as we've ever seen, that championship experience is out the window and it's now a playoff tax. J-Dub not playing in this game, barely played and super ineffective in game 6, dealing with multiple hamstring strains this entire season. And I just think that we need to completely flip it on its head, that championship teams coming into next year are going to be so much more fatigued, have so much more tax. And I think it's not parity in the sense of like, there's so many good teams in the league now. It's just so hard with how hard the game is now and how taxing the game is now to win a championship, go 100 games, and then come back the next year fully healthy and able to compete at that level again. So what we saw tonight was just an extension of the Spurs flipping the script and saying, Victor Wembanyama said it a month ago. He said, we don't have experience, right? Well, screw it. And you saw it tonight. The young guys with zero experience. It's not like Harrison Barnes was making big plays left and right. They just continue to show it's a young man's game and screw experience. It's Wemby's team. The Spurs are here, and they're going to go to the NBA Finals.
For a moment, Tom, when Wemby had 5 fouls and he got taken out of the game and Cornette had to come in, it made me think about how during the USA-France U18 matchup, Wemby, for U17, Wemby fouled out and he was like crying on the sidelines, losing it, really angry with himself, just pissed off at everything. And I was like, wow, this might happen again, but in a game 7. And yet, it did not happen. He did not fall out. He did not commit any more stupid fouls in the game. The Spurs young players made clutch plays down the stretch. It felt like OKC was the more, to your point, trying to go back to back is tough. Experience may not matter quite as much, just like it didn't for OKC last year. It's still a young team. The Spurs were the team that often felt like the more experienced group, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter nowadays. I was just blown away about the amount of winning plays it felt like San Antonio made in this game. Chasing down loose balls, the Cornette block that I mentioned, of course, being the absolute big one that happened. But Wemby's hustle, remember that Jared McCain 3 in transition? And Wemby hustled from half court and in a blink of the eye, Wemby's there. And McCain probably should have pump fake, drove to the basket. But who knows, if he does that, Wemby might recover and block a shot with his 8-foot wingspan from behind. But there's just so many clutch hustle plays by this Spurs team throughout the entire game. Keldon Johnson, I know, like, people I saw on social media, some people saying, I'd be fine if Keldon Johnson got benched for the rest of the game, but he made some clutch rebounds. He had some clutch threes as well. Everybody on this Spurs team ultimately contributed to this victory here. And for Wemby, man, I thought it was the coolest thing after that game, showing all the emotion that he did. We know he wears his heart on his sleeve, but to finally get through Chet Holmgren, finally beat him and just smush him and smash him and make him look completely insignificant. I'm sure for Wemby, that was extra satisfying on top of the fact he led his team to the NBA Finals. Just the way this team rallied around him as well. We saw the photo earlier in the series when Wemby kind of struck a pose looking into the crowd and all of his team, game 1, just looking at him like a basketball god. And then during game 5, I believe it was, when he tried to rally his team, everybody staring at him in the huddle. This is a guy in the third year of his career, and they look to him to be the voice of the team, to be the leader of the team. And then after they win game 7, the way they all just rally around him. And I remember a few years ago with this Spurs team, there are so many times watching the Spurs, Tom, and you know this, when Wemby was a rookie especially, it was like, how can they not throw the ball up to this 7'7" alien? How can they not find this guy in the paint? They don't know what they have. This Spurs group, they know what they have in Victor Wembanyama, and they rally around this guy. And it's truly beautiful to watch. It is, Tom. I'm excited for Spurs fans to be there in the finals and for this team.
It's what the NBA needs. Victor Wembanyama is exactly what the NBA needs. A guy who is appointment viewing for anyone. I don't care if you like the NBA. When you have that guy on your screen, moving the way he does, shooting the way he does, dribbling the way he does, blocking shots the way he does, altering shots where every time they want to get into the paint, they get scared. They either throw it up high off the glass and it falls off the front of the rim, or they just do a business decision and leave it. And the way that Victor Wembanyama cares about winning is the antithesis of the reputation of the league, that these guys, all they care about is getting their money. They're going to take these DNP rests and the load management era. The casual fan is what the NBA needs to bring back. And Victor Wembanyama is that guy, because he's a good villain as a guy who's coming in, not raised in America in the AAU system. Who is this guy that I have to watch a French pro league feed in the NBA app a few years ago to, like, who is this guy? And then he comes in and takes over the NBA in ways that I can't remember a guy third year in the league. This isn't Magic Johnson on the Lakers going to the NBA Finals in his rookie season and doing an amazing job. This is the best player, head and shoulders, the best player on the team, who's in his first playoff run getting to the NBA Finals and doing it in a way that has people out here on X just clowning on Chet Holmgren in ways that he just, honestly, Kev, the way that Wemby destroyed Chet Holmgren once again in this big moment, I think it was kind of a turning of the page for this so-called rivalry. Right now, I have the numbers here, Kev. Against the San Antonio Spurs, Chet Holmgren this year is averaging 10 points a game. Ooh. 10 points a game. 4 points, 4 rebounds tonight, a block, 1-for-2 shooting. The 2 is the big number there. 2 field goal attempts in game 7 for Chet Holmgren when they're praying for any sort of production. Reggie Miller, as Bomani Jones said it on X, he was on Chet's neck, like basically saying, Chet, where are you throughout the game? And Victor Wembanyama is the reason why Chet completely just shriveled up in this game 7 and got taken out down the stretch, Kev. A third team All-NBA player, second in defensive player of the year voting, all defensive team. And he gets pulled in game 7. And I don't think anyone disagreed with that decision.
Look, Chet Holmgren is a very good player. I had him on one of my All-NBA teams. I thought he was deserving for the regular season. But during this series in particular, Tom, he was a complete and utter shrinking violet, afraid of Victor Wembanyama, couldn't handle the ball, couldn't create for himself, couldn't even catch passes cleanly. He was bobbling the ball, slipped on his own feet. He had only 4 rebounds in the game as well. You mentioned the 2 shots, only 2 shots in 33 minutes. Only 4 rebounds as well. And defensively, he made some plays. He had 2 blocks, 2 steals. He did a little bit, but I didn't feel his impact. So, like, the gap between Wemby is number 1 in defensive player in the year voting and Chet at number 2 in defensive player of the year voting is just so enormous. It's the width of the Grand Canyon, man. That's what it is between those two as defensive players. And you can just see it in the numbers, the fact that the Spurs in this game, their defense with Wemby on the floor, 71 shots were taken against their defense. Only 9 of them were at the rim. Only 9 in the restricted area. Only 9. And it's been like that every single game Wemby's been on the floor. It's like that all 7 games. I've talked about it ad nauseum throughout the podcast about how Wemby's presence changes the shot selection of the Oklahoma City Thunder, as he did every single team throughout the entire season and throughout the playoffs. He changes who you want to be. We saw SGA, one of the best drivers in the league, one of the most high-frequency, high-efficiency drivers of the ball, could not get to the rim because of Wemby. Every time SGA was isolated on the side of the floor, Wemby would leave his assignment, go and shade over to the side of SGA, and there's nowhere for SGA to go except for the mid-range and to 3. The paint is inaccessible. And that's because of Wemby. And I thought the broadcast, I mean, they talked obviously about Wemby's defense, but I was very happy that Reggie Miller, I think it was in the middle of the third quarter, they outlined a play where Wemby set a screen, rolled into the paint, opened up the corner three. I think it was for Champagne. Mm-hmm. I might be forgetting. And they, you know, they had the little circles on screen and they're analyzing the play. It was a very basic play. But I love that that was put out there because the San Antonio Spurs, this is one of the reasons why I voted Wemby as MVP. Their offense, in the same way we talk about the way Wemby influences their defense, he also opens up those corner threes with his gravity on rolls to the rim. And I thought he played a sensational game. He opened up so many opportunities for the Spurs on both ends of the floor. And I can't believe we are already at this point with Wemby in year three, Tom. I mean, he still is in his infancy in his offensive development. He doesn't really have any go-to moves yet. You can see them starting to build, right? Some of these turnarounds and these spin moves he has, but he's still just a baby in his development on offense. And yet we're already here. It's terrifying for the rest of the league.
You know that there was one shot that SGA made at the rim in this entire game, in a game seven in which he had 35 points. I mean, his mid-range game was unbelievable. The tough shots, the way he got to his spots, and there was one basket that he made at the rim. Do you remember which one it was? It was right after he took a mid-range jumper and Stephon Castle contested it and SGA dove. He fell onto the floor, did not get a call. And then they got the offensive rebound, and SGA got up, got the ball back, and attacked the rim and went up for a two-handed dunk. And I was sitting there being like, that's the SGA we all want to see. Attacking the rim, seeing the daylight in the paint, and going right at the paint, going up for the dunk or going up for the hard layup. He never got that. He never got daylight in this series because Wemby just camped out in the paint and dared him to attack him at the rim. He was one of three in the basket area because of Wemby. And the only time that he was able to get that, get to the basket and finish was on that offensive rebound where it was kind of like a second chance point, a little bit of scattered defense from the Spurs. And besides that, he could not get into the paint against Victor Wembanyama. And you got to take your hat off, tip your hat for the shot making by SGA, the footwork. He fell a bunch of times in this game, but they didn't reward him every time on those jumpers. But he hit a ton of really tough shots and kept them in the game, exhausted down the stretch. But ultimately, there were so many times, Kevin, in this game that Cason Wallace or Lu Dort or Chet Holmgren, Isaiah Hartenstein, they had to throw multiple bodies at Wemby, boxing him out, and then other guys, Dylan Harper, Devin Vassell, whether it's Keldon Johnson, they were getting these second chance opportunities precisely because of all that rebounding gravity that they were owing to Victor Wembanyama. So it wasn't so much he was getting a ton of offensive rebounds. It was that they were putting 3-4 bodies on him and other guys were getting huge second chance opportunities. 15 offensive rebounds for the Spurs, just to 10 for the Oklahoma City Thunder.
I'm so glad you mentioned the second chance points, Tom, because at one point in this game, it was 20-6 in favor of OKC in second chance points. The game ended 20-17. So San Antonio had a long run of preventing OKC from getting second chance points, but also catching up themselves. Because at one point in the game, I don't have the numbers in front of me for whatever it was in the first half, but OKC had almost nearly as many turnovers as they had made shots, I think, after the first quarter. They were like 3 of 13 from 3 after 1. It was the second chance points keeping them in the game. And then in the second half, I think it was the second chance points that allowed the Spurs to maintain the lead. And I think, as you said correctly, so much of that had to do with OKC having to put multiple guys on Victor Wembanyama to prevent him from just inhaling every rebound. But that led to everybody else getting those chances. And I think for the Spurs, man, them being in the finals, and I've talked about this before where I was wrong with the three guards, with Fox, Harper, and Castle. And I underrated the importance of just having a ton of ball handlers on the floor, right? I mean, and I think you also couldn't have expected Harper to become the shooter he did or Castle the shooter that he has in the second half of this year. But having all those creators juxtaposed against this Thunder team where you're having Alex Caruso attacking one-on-one for like 8 shots in the game, including in the final minute with that 3-pointer he took. That's what they fell back to with AJ Mitchell out, with J-Dub out. And that's the solution. I think having a lot of ball handlers, that's one of the things we've learned in recent years. When the Celtics won the finals 2 years ago, OKC last year with all their creators, and then San Antonio this year, you might say you already have a point guard, but it doesn't hurt to have another one. It really doesn't hurt to have another one. And just imagine how quickly this series would have been over, Tom, if the Thunder had never traded for Jared McCain at the deadline. Right? Like, they didn't need another ball handler, but they traded for that guy. That's part of the reason why they were even in a game 7 in the first place. So that's like one of my big picture thoughts through the experience with the Spurs, drafting Harper and keeping Fox, but also the Thunder with all the guys they lost. They didn't feel like they had enough sources of creation on this roster. And part of that is just Chet Holmgren, Tom, right? Part of that is just Chet. As a top pick in the draft, he has become a very talented player, but he is a now max contract player next season. And 4 points on 2 shots in a must-win game 7. And he couldn't create it all off the dribble. And that, to me, is like one of the stories of the entire series, that Chet could not create at all.
He was terrified of Wemby. Terrified. I mean, there was that play late in the game where he just went into Wemby's chest and Wemby just engulfed him and just like blocked him, and there was nothing he could do. Chet did have a nice block there to kind of keep them in the game at the rim against Dylan Harper. It was a sensational block. But that did not make up for the complete zero that he had in the rest of the game. And Mark Daigneault, think about how much it takes for Mark Daigneault to rely on Kenrich Williams instead of Chet Holmgren down the stretch in this game. And that's exactly what happened. When we talk about Rudy Gobert getting benched down the stretch or Joakim Noah getting benched down the stretch, you know, years ago, and we would clown these guys, it's unfortunate, but Chet Holmgren does deserve the criticism in this game. Without Jalen Williams, without AJ Mitchell, the shot creation and the scoring falls on that guy. And it's unacceptable for him in this game, with all the talent that he has on his home floor in game 7, to take to just 2 shots and be completely absent in that fourth quarter, in which Shai Gilgeous-Alexander only had 4 points in the fourth quarter. Chet Holmgren, 0 points. And of course, J-Dub not playing in this game, 0 points. So those all NBA players, Chet Holmgren, SGA, and J-Dub being hurt, they only had 4 points in that game 7. And that shows, just like, man, if Cason Wallace didn't go absolutely bonkers from downtown, 4 or 5 shooting from 3 in that fourth quarter, haymaker after haymaker from Cason Wallace, this would have been a blowout, like a 25-point blowout if it weren't for Cason Wallace. Because SGA could not penetrate the paint, and Chet Holmgren was nowhere to be seen. He was on a milk carton by the end of that second quarter. And I think Victor Wembanyama, it's all because of that guy. Number one over there on the San Antonio Spurs. Love to see the emotion after the game, because I think he takes a lot of pride in that matchup against Chet Holmgren for years, and finally vanquished OKC, not just in the regular season. We kept hearing that, oh, it's just the regular season. It's just the regular season. What advantage? It's going to be a different story against the defending champs. And ultimately, Victor Wembanyama outlasted all of those OKC fans, all those people who doubted him. And I can understand why he was so emotional after the game, looking into the crowd for his circle, his family. And man, that's exactly what the NBA needs. It's those types of moments that get a lot of people checking their phones the next day and saying, man, he was crying after a game 7 in the conference finals. That guy really wants this. He really cares about the NBA, cares about winning, and that's what the NBA is all about, man.
Tom, I have a question for you about Chet Holmgren here. Are you buying or selling Chet Holmgren stock? Are you viewing this as he's about to be a falling knife and you're selling before the dip begins? Or are you waiting to buy a dip for Chet Holmgren stock after the series?
I think I'm holding. I mean, it just, if the answer is, if the question is Chet Holmgren or Giannis Antetokounmpo.
It might be the question.
I mean, they can do a lot. The OKC can do a lot of things this summer. Certainly with their picks, their pick anything. This year.
They can do anything they want to do, literally anything.
So if they think that Giannis is the guy that can at least do something against Victor Wembanyama, and sometimes we overcorrect this, right? Like they go out and they get Isaiah Hartenstein to help against Jokic and to have a bigger size in the paint and get some more playmaking. But ultimately, like he wasn't able to slow down Wemby in this one. Chet Holmgren obviously can't. So is Giannis Antetokounmpo the guy that Sam Presti looks at and says, all right, we have a once, not at a generation opportunity here, but it doesn't come often that a guy of an MVP candidate could be available and you can basically go get him, not to gut your entire team, but you can go get him with the picks that you have and with a great young player, whether it's J-Dub or Chet Holmgren, and decide if we're going to have a real chance at taking down the San Antonio Spurs that are only going to get better from here on out. Dylan Harper, Stephon Castle, Julian Champagne, Devin Vassell, Victor Wembanyama. It's not just Wemby, guys. It's that entire team. They embodied all of that ferociousness and the physicality that we saw from OKC and Indiana. They brought it this year. And oh, by the way, they got the best player in the NBA. He's the best player in the NBA. And until you figure out a way to stop that guy or slow him down, I don't think that this roster is good enough given how good Wemby's going to be next year. Think about how good he's 22 now. With this experience and with this validation of how good he can be, just imagine how good he's going to be this time next year.
That's, to me, the scary part for the entire league when it comes to what do you do to build against him, right? And obviously we'll see what happens in the finals. We'll talk about the Knicks Spurs a little preview in a little bit, but regarding the Thunder, I do think you really do have to think about Giannis here, given everything that you saw in the series. And I know it went to a game seven. I know if you have a healthy Jalen Williams and if you have a healthy AJ Mitchell, you might have won in six or in five, right? It might not have went to a game seven. But the Spurs are going to get significantly better, and I do think it is worth considering who is best equipped to be a guy that can go toe-to-toe with Victor Wembanyama. Giannis has done a pretty solid job in some of their regular season matchups. Of course, he's older. He's expensive. I have questions about the fit between him and SGA, two guys at their best with the ball in their hands a lot. SGA is not an off-ball player. Giannis will set some screens and roll to the rim, but I don't know about that fit with SGA, and I don't know about the fit with Hartenstein either in the front court. I know that's less important, but I think there's some real fundamental questions about how those two stars would fit together for OKC. Where is it worth giving up all the assets on top of Chet Holmgren to go get him? But it's a conversation worth having. I wish I could be a fly on the wall of that OKC front office debating it, because they inevitably will debate it after losing this series, given there's going to be roster turnover this summer and the following summer with a bunch of deals coming up for guys who are going to have to get paid and you can't pay them all. And I think for the Thunder, I would never say that the window is shut. It is not. This team is still young too, still with a two-time MVP in SGA, who also is better today than he was 1 year ago. He's better as a playmaker. He's better as a three-point shooter off the dribble, even though it didn't show up as much in this series. It definitely did in the regular season. But this Spurs team is definitely on a major ascent here, Tom. Like, that is without a doubt, considering Castle just in year two, Harper as a rookie, Wemby in year three, Vassell still on the younger side, Carter Bryant. We haven't even whispered that name yet today. Carter Bryant, 6'7" with long arms, muscular frame. He might be their four in the years to come. Imagine the lineups they can roll out with Wemby and Carter Bryant and Julian Champagne, two guards in the backcourt. It could be massive across positions with immense skill level across positions, defensive switchability. the Spurs could be in the finals year after year, but we said that 1 year ago with the Thunder too. So, I mean, it's hard to go back to back, obviously. We don't need to get ahead of ourselves here with the team getting to the finals just now tonight. But
yeah, like Kev, what you're talking about here with the youth that San Antonio has, where Stephon Castle did not have a great second half, but what he did to set the tone in that first quarter, game seven on the road in OKC, and to just go attack mode and get this team on their back, and the leadership that you got, have a guy who won championships at UConn. When you see that, where he is fearless going at SGA, I mean, look at that play there where you're seeing Stephon Castle take on this moment and lead them to that big lead early in the game, and just completely not afraid of the moment and not afraid of the circumstance of going to a game seven against the defending champs and beating them. This and then Julian Champagne, Dylan Harper, they're able to pick up the slack there if Stephon Castle doesn't have it in the second half, and they just hit big shot after big shot. Every time Devin Vassell takes a three, I think it's going in. Same thing for Champagne. And that's just, I mean, the way that those role players stepped up on the road in a game seven completely flipped the narrative that role players play better at home. Game seven, you want the team with championship experience. And this whole San Antonio Spurs team, they are the myth-busting San Antonio Spurs. Everything about them says this shouldn't be allowed. This is too soon for this team. And yet, they did it not just against a Detroit Pistons team in a game seven or a Cavs team in a game seven. They did it against OKC, against Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who was just en fuego from mid-range. I mean, some of the shots that SGA hit, 35 points in a game seven in a loss because Chet Holmgren didn't step up and Julian Champagne did.
Tom, it's a short list of all-timers who won the finals in their first playoff appearance. I mean, Michael Jordan didn't do it. LeBron James didn't do it. Magic Johnson did. Bill Russell did. It's not often we see a player even be in this position to win a finals in their first playoff appearance ever. Victor Wembanyama has a chance to do that against the New York Knicks starting next Wednesday night with game one in San Antonio. Undeniably, Wemby continues to check all the boxes of a guy who is on a GOAT trajectory, without a doubt. I mean, he entered the NBA with the expectations of being the most transformative player since LeBron James in 2003, when LeBron entered with all the hype in the world to be a potential GOAT. Wemby has exceeded those expectations through 3 years of his NBA career, becoming this historic level defensive player, the best defender we've seen since the 1960s with Bill Russell, the most impactful defender, the most floor-altering defender since the 60s with Bill Russell. And then offensively, we talked earlier about the impact he makes beyond the box score and how he's still just in his infancy with his on-ball creation. What's interesting to me in this series, and I thought this was apparent especially in Game 6 and Game 7, the Spurs running offense through him more often. To me, it felt like they made a point of putting the ball in Wemby's hands on the perimeter to create plays in the first half. Remember that give and go that we had with Victor Wembanyama, where that was such a beautiful play where he got the poster dunk on Chet Holmgren. But there are so many plays where they put it in Wemby's hands to be the creator. And even though he only had two assists in this game, it's not like it pops up in the numbers, but I thought we saw glimmers of what's to come in the years to come with Wemby as somebody who can be asked to create on top of being the guy making this beyond the box score impact. And that is just unlike anything we have ever seen before. Truly, like there's nothing even close to resembling Victor Wembanyama when he could be an elite shooter and a great playmaker and an all-time great finisher at the basket. This guy truly is on a GOAT trajectory right now, and I don't think it's premature to say that at all, regardless of what happens in the finals, man. But especially if he wins the finals, we are on that path.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, he not only would be on the path to the greatest of all time, he'd be leading that path. Like, he would be ahead of the competition. When we're talking about Michael and how long it took for Mike to get into the NBA Finals and win the championship, and same thing for LeBron James. 23 years old, going to the NBA Finals against San Antonio and losing to Tim Duncan and them. And then he didn't get back there for a long time. And so for Victor Wembanyama to do this at age 22, in his age 22 season for Wemby, going against a New York Knicks team and Jalen Brunson, Karl Anthony Towns, OG Anunoby, they are so tough. The way that they've completely turned things around is starting with that Atlanta Hawks series when they got down, lost those two games, and CJ McCollum was going off. And ever since, you put Karl Anthony Towns as the fulcrum of that offense. And yeah, it's not every time down the floor, but the way that he has been able to preserve his energy for the defensive end and recalibrate his entire game to being more of a facilitator, I think what you see from Victor Wembanyama is you're going to have a lot of physicality with him without fouling. And that's the thing that scares me, Kevin, about Karl Anthony Towns in this next series, is he's going to be so jacked up to face Victor Wembanyama and prove that he's going to be the best big man in this series. I don't know if Mike Brown
good luck.
Is good. He's going to need all the luck he can take in this series, because the height factor, the skill factor, the shooting, this isn't Embiid. This isn't Evan Mobley. This isn't throw any other East big out there outside of Giannis Antetokounmpo. It's not a Kongwu. It's going to be a totally different game for Karl Anthony Towns. And the fact is, I think Mike Brown might be better off putting OG Anunoby on Victor Wembanyama with how strong he is and his base, how long OG is. I think you put OG on Victor Wembanyama and have Karl Anthony Towns off ball, because I just don't trust Karl Anthony Towns, even though he just did this, swept two teams in the Eastern Conference to get to the finals. I just think he might get too hype going against Victor Wembanyama, and those old habits might creep up again. I think OG might be the better defender against Wemby, at least to start.
I think you're going to see the Knicks try a bunch of different defenses against Wemby. I think you're going to see them start with OG Anunoby. I wouldn't be surprised if that's the game one game plan, to your point, Tom. I don't know if that's going to work. I don't know if that's going to be effective for you. Then Karl Anthony Towns, who's he helping off of? You know, who's he roaming off of? That's the thing with the Spurs team, because everybody can shoot. Harper and Castle are still at over 40% on catch and shoot threes since the middle of February. They were supposed to be the weak links, the guys I helped off of. Now we saw in this game, especially in the second half, helping off of Keldon Johnson. Keldon Johnson can hit open threes when you give him enough space, but he's the guy you at least tried it against on some possessions. I worry about this series for the Knicks, Tom. Mm-hmm. I mean, I need to dive into it. I want to watch their prior matchups from during the season. I don't know how relevant they are. They last played in early March. The other matchup was very early in the year as well. But, and of course, the NBA Cup. This is a rematch, right, of the NBA yeah. Cup. So we get
the
a
difference
rematch.
Is Wemby was coming off the bench in those games
yes,
early in the minutes. Season.
Yes.
It was a totally different environment, totally different season. And I would say, to the Knicks' credit, they would say, yeah, we're a totally different team as of, you know, a month ago. But still, like, you can't really read too much into the regular season matchups. NBA Cup final, we can watch that. But so different, both teams, ever since then. And I think the biggest factor for me, watching this Knicks team up to this point, the thing that gave them the most trouble and the reason why they went to Carl Towns as the fulcrum of the offense was because of the Nikhil Alexander Walker, Dyson Daniels, the length that they had, the defense that they had, and the physicality, the perimeter defenders that they had that they could throw at Jalen Brunson. The Cavs didn't have that. The Sixers didn't have that. You know who has those long in your jersey defenders? It's San Antonio. It's OKC.
A lot of them.
A lot of them, man. And they're here for it. They're here for that life. And so going from the Sixers and the matchup that you're seeing in this, the Cavs and Sixers, going from them to the San Antonio perimeter defense is going to be night and day. And so that's where I think Jalen Brunson is going to be really tested. It's going to be exhausting going against Dylan Harper, Champagne, Devin Vassell. Stephon Castle is going to get that assignment. And man, The piranhas of San Antonio are going to be out for Jalen Brunson, and that's why everything, man, it comes back down to Karl Anthony Towns. Can he be the facilitator and the playmaker that he was up until this point, averaging just about 7 game at Karl Anthony Towns, or is he going to revolve back to that guy that we saw last year and in Minnesota runs previously, where he's just going to try to be that scorer and go at you in ways that I think Mike Brown has unlocked something in Karl Anthony Towns. And that better be the case against the San Antonio Spurs, because they are going to give Jalen Brunson hell out there in this finals.
I think piggybacking off what you said, Tom, I'm curious for people watching live on YouTube and also people listening to the audio podcast after the fact, listening on Spotify, leave a comment letting us know what you think about what Tom just hit on there. Is this going to be the difference in the series here? Is it possible that this ends up being a quicker series, considering the way the Spurs can match up against Jalen Brunson that Tom just described? I think there is a chance of that, Tom. I'm not making a prediction here. I want to take the weekend and think about it before, you know, doing a prediction full finals preview show early next week before the finals begin. But that's a legitimate real concern. Like, Cleveland had nobody at the level that San Antonio has. San Antonio has like 3 or 4 guys better than anybody on the Cavaliers at handling a Jalen Brunson, at handling a Mikal Bridges pull up, at handling Josh Hart connective playmaking, at handling Karl Anthony Towns playmaking from the middle of the floor. They have the best defender in the world in Victor Wembanyama. I worry that this could be matchup hell for the Knicks.
Yeah.
I worry badly.
Yeah. And Kev, I think really what it comes down to is the Knicks rest versus rust. You know, if they can take this time off and recharge the batteries in ways that the San Antonio Spurs are coming in with a grueling 7-game series, and then in 3 days have to turn around and play the best point differential we've ever seen going into the NBA Finals, plus 262 in their last 11 games, clearing every team in playoff history by 70 points in point differential over any 11-game span. We hit this on the big number this week, which is like the Knicks are on an all-time heater. And can they keep those flames going with 8 days off before Game 1 on Wednesday, June 3rd, and you have the San Antonio Spurs, who have a banged-up De'Aaron Fox. He had his best game, I thought, Kev, in the entire postseason, De'Aaron Fox. He had a little bit more zip, making plays for others, staying within himself. Until the very last couple minutes of the game, San Antonio had just 6 turnovers against that OKC defense that was all-time good at turning you over. And so, for me, when you look at the ability of De'Aaron Fox to get healthy in time for the finals, and maybe, you know, Dylan Harper gets a little bit more rest, he was a little banged up in this series, that to me is going to be the best chance for the Knicks, that they are going to be rested and they're going to be able to take advantage of this grueling 7-game series that they just had against OKC. And that to me is the best hope, is that you got Jalen Brunson with the ball and a lot more rest than the San Antonio Spurs team that was exhausted. And you saw the emotions on Victor Wembanyama. That wasn't just about relief. That was, I think, just he was running on empty, man. And the elation to not have to play anymore against this OKC team and be able to come out with a victory. I think there was a lot of emotion there that was just like, I did it. You know, I think that for him, that felt like an NBA Finals. Obviously, he hasn't played in NBA Finals, but you could see the emotion and the celebration at the end of that game. He's going to have to dig deep against this New York Knicks team because they're going to be well-rested. I don't know if that's going to be enough, but that 8 days rest might be the most important variable coming up in the NBA Finals.
And I think the you just hit on the counter-argument to everything we just said kind of in San Antonio's favor. The counter-argument is the Knicks are well-rested, but also they have a lot of points of attack. The limitations with the Thunder was the fact they had SGA, then no J-Dub, no AJ Mitchell, and then Jared McCain and Alex Caruso. You know, like that's where it fell down to. The roster was depleted. The Knicks can attack you with Jalen Brunson, with his his short, stout playmaking ability, get anywhere he wants on the floor. They can run things through Mikal Bridges. You can feel comfortable with him attacking off the dribble, running a secondary pick and roll. OG Anunoby can do the same thing. Karl Anthony Towns can post up mismatches. He can create from the outside. He can attack a closeout 10 times better than Chet Holmgren can. You have to worry about Kat if he's attacking off the dribble against a rotating defense. Off the bench, Jordan Clarkson, Miles McBride, Jose Alvarado, up and down this Knicks roster, they have good talent that can shoot, dribble, and pass. It is littered with talent, and it's well-rested. So in that sense, that could make the Knicks a far more challenging offense for San Antonio to have to defend, when already we saw the Spurs go to a Game 7 against the Thunder team, against SGA, who did not have a great series, a team without their second and third best ball handlers. So that could be the argument in favor of the Knicks in this series, where everybody's picking the Spurs, everybody's picking Wemby in five. We're watching an all-time great. But then this Knicks team comes in that has won 11 in a row in dominant fashion, as you said, the most dominant fashion in NBA playoff history. And they might prove themselves like, hey, you've been overlooking over us all along. NBA Cup champs and NBA Finals champs, baby. That's what we might see for the first time in history.
Look, man, the Knicks fans, my group chats from back home, I mean, they are on a high right now, and they should be, because they've won 11 straight games. But this OKC team had 8 straight games, swept both the Lakers and the Suns going into that series with home court advantage, by the way, and still lost. So this Knicks team won't have home court advantage, and they're going to go against Victor Wembanyama, who is just towering over any, and Mitchell Robinson. I guess we talk about it here. News came out that he has a broken pinky and had a procedure done, and hopes to be ready in time for game one of the NBA Finals. I don't know how much of an injury factor that is for you in your eyes, Kevin, but they're going to need second chance opportunities against this San Antonio Spurs team, and they're going to need fouls, and they're going to need physicality. And if Mitchell Robinson isn't able to get those rebounds, 'cause he's got a broken hand, he's going to have to just rely on tap outs, which he's elite, maybe the best in the NBA at it. But that's a scary injury for this team going against Wemby.
Mike Brown seems so pissed off at him in his presser this week. He stressed, it didn't happen during basketball activities. It did not happen during basketball activities. Well, how did it happen? He slammed his hand playing video games. Did he punch a wall? Did he skateboard? I don't know. What did he do?
Monte Ellis, the moped, that one from Monte.
Remember years ago, Rajon Rondo had a fall out of the shower. Remember that? I think he broke his hand, a fall out of the shower. If I remember correctly, that was like the cover story for whatever actually happened. Maybe.
Hey, Pablo, we need to get Pablo Torre on the case. What really happened with Mitchell Robinson? How did he break his pinky? Is going into the NBA Finals and having an injury that could jeopardize your status for the NBA Finals in a non-basketball circumstance? Oof. And you're going against Victor Wembanyama. Like, you can survive if it's like, I'm going against Hartenstein, which, that would have been a cool matchup. But the NBA, man, this is awesome. NBA Cup rematch in the NBA Finals, the 1999 NBA Finals rematch. So cool. Wemby going against Jalen Brunson. This is going to be so fun to watch. And like you said, the Spurs just did what the Knicks are trying to do, where it's like, we shut down this OKC team after they were on an all-time heater, 8 straight wins going into that series. And the Knicks are a little bit hotter than OKC was going into that series, but they don't have home court advantage in this one, Kev. And so, like, they're going to need every edge they can find.
Does this finals matchup legitimize the NBA Cup?
I love the NBA Cup. I agree.
That's almost a question for the listeners who are doubtful about it. I love the cup too. I think it's fun. It makes the early season a bit more interesting, but I do think it could legitimize it in the eyes of a lot of people, especially if the NBA, presses on ABC to say, hey, this is a cup rematch.
Yeah. Oh, you know, yeah. there are a lot of boardrooms right now going on, yeah, and just saying rematch. Rematch. You know that's going to happen. I mean, it's it. Maybe this will spur, no pun intended, the NBA to like acknowledge the play-in championship stats, because if I'm an analyst trying to look up these stats, it's going to be a lot trickier now because they don't count. They're not going to be on game logs, etc. So I know that doesn't really matter in the grand scheme of things, and fans aren't really harping on that. Another pun. Sorry, harp. I do think that this is a cool story for the league, a dream matchup. Like if you were going to do a big board of all of the dream matchups for the NBA, the Knicks in the NBA Finals, period, is high up on that list. And then secondly, you get a rematch of the NBA Cup in the 99 Finals. There's history here. There's bad blood here. And I think coming off that OKC San Antonio series, this is going to be between New York and San Antonio. I can't wait. I mean, it's what we've been waiting for all season long. Is this the NBA at the pinnacle, getting these two teams going against each other? It's going to be awesome.
Obviously, in the Eastern Conference, the Knicks swept their way to the NBA Finals, but it's not often we get Game 7s in the Western Conference Finals. It's been since 2018 between the Warriors and Rockets, 2016 between the Warriors and Thunder, and then 2002, Lakers-Kings, 2000, Lakers-Blazers. It hasn't been many of them in the 21st century. So it was nice to get one, and it was an epic series. A bit of a strange series. I should rephrase that. It was an epic Game 1, an epic Game 7, a pretty good Game 2, and a bunch of blowouts. But I think when you zoom out and look at the series, it was haymaker one game, haymaker another game. Teams playing with effort and force and intensity, swinging in different directions, all culminating into the great Game 7 that we saw. So I think for hopefully – this is the beginning of a Spurs-Thunder rivalry. I hope it's not one-sided. I hope we see these teams go back and forth in the years to come with some great, epic, deep playoff battle series, because that's what people hope for, is organic rivalries. And I do think there's some real animosity between these two teams. A lot of the talk was about the officiating, and I'm glad we haven't even spoken about officials until now. This is a well-officiated game tonight. But the aggression on both sides, the toughness, Wemby, you know, whatever he whispered into the ears of Biombo and Plumlee at the end of game 6 and or game 5, whatever was said to Carter Bryant saying, "I'm proud of you," if that was after the push of SGA, and never mind all the following on the OKC side. There's definitely some animosity between these teams, and I hope we see them match up again in the future. I do hope we get an organic rivalry here, Tom, because that is one thing. The NBA must be very happy to have Knicks in the finals, especially Wemby in the finals. That could lead to a ratings boom for watching live games. But also, we do need some organic rivalries to form in the coming years, and I think we might have one between the Thunder and the Spurs.
Yeah, no doubt. This is the start of many battles between these two teams. And you know, you look at the injury to Jalen Williams, and that might be enough for Sam Presti to just say, look, we're going to run it back next year. We're not going to do any wholesale changes to this team, because I think everyone in the league is looking at Victor Wembanyama and saying, yeah, he might on the floor be the best player in the NBA. I've long felt he's the best player in the NBA. I didn't need this Game 7 to prove that, especially considering SGA had an incredible Game 7. It's not like the Spurs winning changed the math for me. I think Victor Wembanyama, what he does, and warps both ends of the floor, where you have to have a guard against him to stay with him because his handle is so good, his shot is so good, but he's also dunking all over everybody like Shaq. It's just, he's such a calculus scrambler for every team that faces him. And the only way that teams are going to have hope against the San Antonio Spurs is that he doesn't stay healthy. And I think that's the only thing that for opposing teams to look at, because the supporting cast, the way that Dylan Harper might be the best young guard in the NBA, and then you look like like what he did in this postseason, along with Stephon Castle, that backcourt is going to be so good in 5 years. And then that's going to be in Wemby's prime. The only way that they're going to be unseated here, I think, is if Victor Wembanyama's body does not hold up in this 82 game plus the postseason grind. And I think for OKC, looking at the Knicks and the run that they've made, and looking at Nikola Jokic still in the Western Conference, and who knows what the Lakers are going to do with this new ownership run by the Dodgers team, and the leadership, I feel like OKC might look at this Jalen Williams injury, and AJ Mitchell, we should not discount the injury to AJ Mitchell, who was awesome for them as a second creator for SGA in the regular season and postseason. I would be surprised if they made a major trade. And what does a major trade look like? I think, in my eyes, does Sam Presti look at this roster and say, we're going to move Jalen Williams, J-Dub. We're going to move Chet Holmgren. That would be considered, to me, a major change. And I think those two injuries to AJ Mitchell and Jalen Williams is enough for me to say, no. Nah. That would be too much of a knee-jerk response. We went to Game 7 with against Victor Wembanyama. We had home court. We were right there down the stretch. Didn't pull it out. Against this New York Knicks team, maybe they win that series without Jalen Williams because that hamstring was so injured. But to me, I don't see, after losing this series against San Antonio, that Sam Presti is going to press that nuclear option. I think there's too many injuries on their side, and maybe they just have a healthy offseason, rehab Jalen Williams. They got Sorber back next year, Topic back next year, and maybe that's going to be enough to take down San Antonio. But right now, I don't see how it's weird saying this ahead of the NBA Finals. We haven't seen the NBA Finals yet, but I think every other team in the NBA knows what we're seeing in Victor Wembanyama, and that is the best player over the next decade plus if he stays healthy.
I mean, it's been interesting. I've interviewed a couple of draft prospects on the podcast this week, and I think two of them at least have mentioned, well, the big guy Wemby down there. I know Nate Ament, I had him on my podcast this week talking about the value of the mid-range jumper, and he pointed to there's going to be playoff series that you can't get to the rim. You need to have a mid-range game, a perimeter game. You can't just rely on getting to the basket, and I think that is 100% the truth. And I think when it comes to team building philosophy for how to counter Victor Wembanyama, we're going to get a pretty good test of that with this finals, because I think, to your point, Tom, is it going to be Cat who defends Wemby, or is it going to be OG and Anunoby who defends Wemby? What's the more effective way of doing it? What's the best way of countering him on offense? Is it with a bunch of mid-range pull-up guys? Could Bridges have an amazing series as an amazing mid-range shooter? Could he be one of the keys to victory here? Is actually having a smaller guy like Jalen Brunson actually more valuable than a guy with SGA's size and height against Victor Wembanyama? Could that be actually the case, where being 6 foot, being a little lower to the floor, helps you out a little bit? I don't know. I'm just throwing straight thoughts out at you, Tom, because I think these are the conversations teams are having now when it comes to how do you build for contention during the Victor Wembanyama era, because we have entered it regardless of what happens in the NBA Finals. We are in the Victor Wembanyama era, and every front office is thinking about how to best build their rosters to beat that guy. Maybe not just next year, but the year after that, next 4, 5, 6, 7 years, because he's not going away anytime soon. He's only going to get better. So I think this Knicks series really will be a good test of some of those philosophies for teams to think about.
Yeah, Mikal Bridges is a selective mid-range shooter, an elite mid-range shooter, but he only took 1.6 mid-range jumpers in this postseason run per game. So one, maybe two per game in this postseason run. He hasn't really needed to, because they don't have Victor Wembanyama's in the Eastern Conference, but they're going to need that. Jalen Brunson, not really a high-volume mid-range guy. I think he's around 21st. Between 20 and 25th in the NBA in mid-range field goal attempts per game this postseason. So SGA led that by a mile, and that was all he had in game seven here was it was pulling up in those mid-range in that mid-range area and on those threes. He was automatic in this game seven, and it still wasn't enough. I mean, the Spurs defense, they shut down OKC. It's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, the two-time MVP. He led an offense that was about 105 points every 100 possessions against the San Antonio Spurs defense. They were around 120 in the regular season, and Victor Wembanyama knocked that down all the way to around 105 in this series with home court advantage. And that's with the unconscious shooting of Alex Caruso in game one and throughout this series until he just turned it into a pumpkin in game seven. And so I think the mid-range is going to – they're going to have to get him in foul trouble. They're going to have to go through his chest. OG is as strong as it comes. He's a battering ram when he gets into the paint. So strong. Mikal Bridges is good in the mid-range. Jalen Brunson with his footwork able to get free throws, getting guys off the ground. The thing with Victor Wembanyama is, though, he doesn't need to jump. Like, Kev, that's one of the reasons why his foul rate is so low. Wilt Chamberlain-esque when it comes to the foul rate of Victor Wembanyama is because he doesn't need to jump in order to block your shot. And against Jalen Brunson, it's going to be even more imperative for him to just stay down on shooters and not fall for the pump fake, which I think Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, Dwayne Wade, Jalen Brunson, all-time great at getting you into the air. And it's going to be imperative for Victor Wembanyama to not bite on those pump fakes because, man, the Knicks are going to try to get him in foul trouble because that's going to be their best shot.
Just one more thing I want to bring us back to here, Tom, regarding OKC. The roster turnover aspect, you mentioned you don't think any big moves will come. I'm not so sure there. Their current salary for next year is $250 million. That's over the second apron. That is in the luxury tax, deep into the luxury tax. Chet's going to be making $41.5 million. J-Dub's going to be making $41.5 million, tied for the highest paid players on the Thunder. Their salaries go from rookie scale to max. And I think you might see a Lu Dort dealt. You might see Isaiah Hartenstein opt out of his contract and re-sign for a lower number long-term, like a four-year 75, 4 years 80. I think that's a possibility this offseason. I'm sure Oklahoma City is hoping for that. But I do think there's a possibility you see a Dort dealt, an Isaiah Joe dealt in order to lower that number, rather than perhaps, to your point, dealing Jalen Williams, dealing Chet Holmgren. That seems a little bit more, I think it's a worthy debate, yeah. And very well, it might be the right thing to do. But I think what's a certainty is you see some of these key role players, Lu Dort, Isaiah Joe, Aaron Wiggins specifically, those guys could be easily on the way out in favor of some of the young kids coming up that are on rookie scale contracts. That's what I would expect to happen. But that said though, Tom, if there's any validity to the truth, to the rumors about Oklahoma City trying to trade up in the drafts, it's been reported by multiple people now about the Thunder having interest in moving up to go get Cam Boozer or to move up and get somebody, whoever the target is. Chet Holmgren would be one hell of a piece to dangle. If you perceive Cam Boozer or Caleb Wilson or Adai Mara as a better fitting piece for your team to battle Wemby in the years to come. So I just think it's something worth debating and something worth thinking about. I almost think that path makes a little bit more sense than going the Giannis path, because I really do have questions about the Giannis SGA fit. But I do think you're going to see some changes, just a matter of how big and to what degree for the Thunder.
All right. Well, let's play that game right now. All right. So the top of the draft, Washington, Utah, Memphis, Chicago. I'm looking at this. Who would take Chet? Like, I think I would do that right now, is I would trade Chet Holmgren to move up to get Cam Boozer. I think he's a better player, better prospect. He's stronger, better playmaker. He's not the rim protector that Chet Holmgren is, but in terms of shooting, playmaking, strength, size, yes, that is the prototype that you're going to want to have on your team going against Wembanyama, where you have a second playmaker, a guy that can shoot, spread the floor, pull you out, and he's got the size to play at the five. Not the rim protection of Chet Holmgren, but if I'm OKC and I have the ability to move up to go get Cam Boozer, I do that. I'm such a believer in Cam Boozer's upside as a productive, perennial all-star, all-NBA, MVP caliber player. I know a lot of people don't see it that way, but I firmly believe that if OKC has the opportunity to get Cam Boozer in this draft and it means they give up Chet Holmgren, I seriously consider that. I would if I'm Sam Presti, I'm doing a lot of intel on Cam Boozer, and I'm sitting here and looking at the type of player that he is and the shooting, the playmaking, the IQ out on the floor. I think Cam Boozer is going to be a better NBA player at his peak than Chet Holmgren. And if that is the calculus, I think you make that move. The question is, does Chicago or Memphis or Utah make the move for a here and now player at the number that he's going to be paid at, $200 million plus going forward? It's one thing to get Cam Boozer, and it's another thing to have to pay him at a very discounted rate, mid-level exception and below, for the next 4 years. Does someone like Memphis or Chicago or Utah bite on Chet Holmgren or Jalen Williams? I don't know, man. They're not on their rookie scale contracts anymore, but Chicago might do it just because they are in a market that feels like maybe we want to win right now. And they've never shown the affinity for bottoming me out, but they have a new front office here. Even if Sam Presti dangled Chet Holmgren to Memphis and Chicago to move up into the draft to get Cam Boozer, and that might not be enough. Utah might take him. Washington might take him. I don't know if that's enough. What do you think?
I think there's a chance Cam Boozer goes number one. So you might want Cam Boozer. You might not be able to get Cam Boozer. I think there's a chance of that. I'm not sold on this order being what everybody thinks it is, with AJD Bonson number one, Peterson two, Boozer three, Wilson four. That could change. The Bulls are doing their due diligence on other prospects. They're bringing in other guys for workouts, not just for number 15, but they're thinking about number four. I had the guy on my podcast the other day. Nate Ament was on my show, and we talked about how he's doing a workout with the Chicago Bulls. I mean, and he's doing a workout with the Brooklyn Nets as well. So there's other names that are in these conversations here. Mykal Brown said on my show how his first workout this week was with the Utah Jazz. Why are the Utah Jazz with the number two pick working out Mykal Brown? Because they're doing their due diligence to find out if they actually say, we'd rather trade down to number five and get Mykal Brown there and a ton of assets and good quality talent to move down from two instead of taking Peterson if they have questions about his durability or his fit with the roster. So these teams in the top four, Washington, Utah, Memphis, and Chicago, are turning over every stone. And I think the formula for the Thunder to get into that range to get Cam Boozer or whoever the target truly is, I think it's to move to number five with the LA Clippers. The Clippers are one of the most likely trade down teams. They got fortunate to land that fifth pick. They don't necessarily need any of the guards there. It would be advantageous for the Clippers to get 12 and 17, a good player, a future first, a pretty high price to move down seven spots, but worth it for the Thunder. And then from there, from the fifth spot, that's where the Thunder, I believe, would try to move into the top three range from that spot, either two or three for Boozer. I don't think Boozer would be there for four. I think he's gone by four. I'd be shocked if he were still on the table at four. So I think it would have to be Utah at two or Grizzlies at three. And Utah at two feels like the team that would be a bit more in a position to say, you know what, let's get more draft capital. We'll restore what we lost to go get Jaren Jackson Jr. and more, and still get a guy that we think have number three on our board or number two on our board with the fifth pick, in the same way that the Angels did in Boston, where they traded down from one to three in the Fultz Tatum year. So that's my kind of like putting pieces together if this were to happen approach, the way I'm thinking about things here. And who knows, OKC might just stay at number 12 and trade away number 17 for a future first round pick, and that's it. That might be all that happens on draft night or in the weeks leading up to the draft. But I do think there's a lot of logic to them moving up and being aggressive to go get Cam Boozer, especially after the serious loss. And That's the fun part about this time of year, isn't it, Tom? Right? Like, we get the NBA finals with the Knicks and the Spurs starting on Wednesday night. And we also have an unbelievable NBA draft this year that is going to be full of, I think, rumors ramping up during the finals. A lot of stories going to be coming out about what teams are going to do. We're already there with the Thunder. That's only going to get ramped up even more. Potentially a crazy free agency trade season around the corner with Giannis Antetokounmpo, his future in Milwaukee. Who knows who's going to step up to try to get him? Is it a mystery team? Is it the Thunder? Who's it going to be? Is it just Miami like everybody expects? We are about to enter, as we turn the page to June, the best time of the calendar year for the NBA. I'm just fired up, man. I'm just excited. It's Saturday night right now. There's nothing else I'd rather be doing than talking about the NBA right now on Saturday night. Forget about the club. For our people in the YouTube chat, forget about the club. You're here with us. This is where you want to be. This is the best club place KFC. To be on a Saturday night.
Yeah. Yeah. Saturday Night Live.
The Kevin O. Clubbers. What's up, clubbers?
Don't do this. What's up, clubbers? Oh man, I feel like Steve Buscemi. What's up? How are you doing out here, clubbers, out here on a Saturday night? The NBA. The NBA is in good hands right now. I think Jalen Brunson, the New York market, Victor Wembanyama going against them. David Stern is looking down on this and just smiling because it's great theater. It's going to be great theater. What we have, a great draft lined up. Like, you talk about Washington and Utah, 1 and 2 in the draft. They have enough good pieces on their team. I'm not a huge fan of Trae Young and Anthony Davis, but there is enough there in Utah and Washington. Now that OKC has been eliminated, that things get really interesting. If OKC dangles Jalen Williams or Chet Holmgren to those two rosters, because those two ownership groups and front offices might look at this and say, we're not that far away. We're not that far away. If there's no more tanking, if this is it, maybe Utah says we're all in on the AJ DeBonta business. And if we can't get AJ at two, then maybe they just say, Lowry Markin and Chet Holmgren and Walker Kessler and Keontae George and Ace Bailey going forward. How many wins do they get there? Because they had an all-time bad defense, and now you get the second best defensive player of the year. One of the premier defenders in Chet Holmgren would be a lock and key fit for that Utah Jazz team. Maybe they look at Cam Boozer and just say, there's too many guys with the ball in their hands, not enough defense. He's not a great fit for us. I beg to differ on that one. But with Washington and with Utah, if Sam Presti calls them up and says, look, we can't have all these guys on our squad right now, and the tax situation going forward, we want to retool. Do they look at their situation and say, we're not that far away in the Eastern Conference for Washington. We're not that far away in the West with all of those pieces in Utah. Maybe they decide, yeah, let's go and get a guy like that right now. So very interesting. The draft just got a lot more interesting with OKC and all their assets in the ring right now for potentially moving up. I would do it if I'm OKC. I would go get Cam Boozer, even if it means giving up Jalen Williams or Chet Holmgren.
I think they should too, Tom. I do. I think I am. My big board and mocks are going to be updated next week. I'll tell you what, Tom. I am very strongly considering just putting Boozer at number one on my board. I had him at 3 at one point, and then I moved him up to 2. I am on the verge of moving Boozer to 1 on my board, and I just think there's a level of safety with him, but also still massive upside. When you talk about a guy who's 6'9", can handle the ball, can post up, can screen and roll, makes instant decisions as a passer, is an elite shooter, an elite rebounder, an elite finisher, always in the right position on defense. Let's not overthink things here. Like, how many times have teams bet on higher upside, quote unquote higher upside, with the number one or number two pick, and it ends up being, oh, the rock solid guy who ends up being the best player in the draft class, because it turns out he's better than rock solid. And that's
where it reminds me of Luka.
Yeah,
it reminds me of Luka.
That's a great way to put it. I had Luka won that year on my board. Even I still can't believe Ayton and Bagley went ahead of Luka. I still can't believe the Hawks traded out of that pick for Trae Young. Baffling. I don't get how Luka wasn't the number one pick that year. It never made any sense. But that's a perfect way to put it. Perfect way to put it. There was a level of safety with Luka, and that, okay, he's 6'7" and he can handle the ball and shoot off the dribble, and he's a magnificent passer. He's gonna be a really good player, and who knows what level he'll reach as a player. And he ends up reaching great heights. He'll be an MVP candidate for many years to come, assuming he stays healthy. It's very much the same way with Cam Boozer. You're right, Tom. That's a perfect way to put it. It really is.
Yeah, and they look at him, they're like, how much athleticism does he have? And like, what's it like? He's not going to be a guy who can match DeBonce or Darren Peterson's athleticism. And I'm just like, at the end of the day, he's a hooper. He's super skilled, crazy skilled, and super strong. And great. I mean, I've been banging this drum for years, and you see Dylan Harper out there not looking scared at all. Second generation guy, Jalen Brunson in the NBA Finals, leading the Knicks against all odds and getting that deal from the New York Knicks and being the king of New York, might go down as the greatest Knick ever. And he was a second round pick because they looked at him and said, he's topped out. He's topped out. And I wonder if there's some of that with Cam Boozer. Whereas as much winning as he did at Duke, and as much of a skilled player as he is at Duke, all you're hearing is like, oh, he's a ground player. He's not going to be able to be athletic or rising. He's not an above the rim guy. And I just look at this and I'm saying, I feel like we're just focusing so much on the things he can't, quote unquote, do, and not on the things that he was able to do at Duke last year. And so I just think everything, he's the full package. And if I'm Sam Presti, I would do just about everything it would take to move up into the draft, and they're not going to have to do too much because they're already have a high pick here at number 12 and 17. So package that. I don't know. And future first round picks, when you have this window with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, you might just have to do it.
One last thing, I promise. I forgot to mention it earlier. Since you just mentioned Brunson going to the finals and all that, Knicks fans were on my butt this week because I didn't have Brunson on my All-NBA teams. They were on me hard. First of all, when people said, oh, you just did this for attention. No, I didn't. I revealed my ballot in the middle of April, and I thought nothing of it, having Brunson off my teams. No Knicks fans said anything to me at the time when I did it, when I put my ballot out there and posted my All-NBA selections. Nobody was on me then. I think it was just the fact the Knicks made the finals here where it looks terrible. And obviously it is terrible. I should have had Brunson on a team, probably over ahead of Jalen Johnson or your guy, Denny Avdia, or probably ahead of Maxey, but Maxey had a great year. Anyway, point being, I screwed up the Brunson selection. I screwed up Jalen Duren as most improved player. Boy, am I glad I was one of five people to have Victor Wembanyama as the MVP. I feel really good about that. And that wasn't like just four clicks choice either. That was really what I thought after doing way too much research. I mean, I poured hours into that decision to pick Wemby over SGA. Went into it thinking I would pick SGA, and it turned into Wemby. And I do feel like these playoffs they reveal so much. They reveal who the truly great players are. And they revealed a lot about Jalen Brunson this postseason. And it also did reveal a lot about Victor Wembanyama. I think a lot of people saw the impact he makes beyond the box score on both offense and obviously on defense. That's quite clear, but on offense as well. And I feel good about that choice, even though SGA fully deserving as a two-time MVP. He had a historic regular season offensively. Without a doubt, it was the toughest MVP choice I've ever made. But I do feel good about being one of five to pick Wemby, Tom. Just have to pat myself on the back there after getting heat for Brunson this week and getting heat for Duren the week prior to that. Voting puts you on the hot seat.
I had Duren on my second team All-NBA. So it's just, I don't know. Kev, I know it's past midnight here and we've talked about a lot of things, but this is something that I'm like, I'm truly troubled by the logic of Like, do I look at what Jalen Duren did in the postseason and regret putting him second team all NBA? And yes, part of me says yes, but it's a regular season award, right? Like, we can't, I guess my question to you is, what did you see now from Jalen Brunson that makes you think you regret putting him off your ballot, that you put someone else in that spot? Is it that, like, Denny Avdia is not playing in the NBA finals? Is it that Tyrese Maxey is not, it got swept by Jalen Brunson, not, in the New York Knicks?
Like, it's specifically, I can tell you exactly what it is. It's something Jonathan Macri said to me on my Knicks Roundtable podcast this week. He said, "I think you undervalued the leadership." And yeah. He's right. I undervalued that intangible X factor aspect that is so important and critical to the success and failure of NBA teams. The Knicks were a 3 seed, a 53 win team, in part because of who Jalen Brunson is and what he means to that team on the court and off the court. And I said to Macri and C. Peter on the podcast that him saying that made me think of a conversation I had with a GM years ago when he was ranting and raving to me about how insane media members are for voting Harden as MVP, saying this, like, you guys are missing it. You're missing the point of LeBron's leadership. LeBron should be the MVP. Harden is not a leader. He does not lead this team. They do not believe in him. How can you be the MVP when your team does not have a level of belief in you, when you can't lead your squad in the biggest moments? How is that an MVP? This GM said to me a decade ago almost. And I think there's some truth to that. And that's what I missed with Brunson. And I think that has become quite obvious over the postseason. And Macri bringing that up in that moment is like, yes, that is what I miss over Jalen Johnson, where you can talk about the numbers and talk about the yep. impact he makes. And you can talk about Denny Avdia, the downhill attacking and the two-way play and all that. You can talk about Maxey as better numbers, better defense. But Brunson is the heart and soul of a franchise. And there is something to that, an intangible quality that I feel like I missed with Brunson, and that I feel like I hit on Wemby, right or wrong. You can just, I mean, it was a regular season award, SGA was deserving, but as one of five that voted Wemby, I do think there was an aspect of that with Wemby that I found that for whatever reason I overlooked with Brunson.
And Sean Sweeney and Mitch Johnson, the coaching that they did in this series and all yep. postseason long and all regular season long. Sean yep. Sweeney joining that bench last year was a big reason why I picked Mitch Johnson to have coach of the year, because I just think those two guys, the intel they had, Wemby's growth was the reason why I picked Mitch Johnson to win coach of the year this year. And they had the biggest jump year over the biggest gain above their preseason Vegas win projection, the San Antonio Spurs. And so I just feel like when you're talking about the talent that San Antonio has, the talent that the Knicks have, and the way that they're playing right now, it obviously, to get to this stage in the NBA Finals, you have to be rolling, right? But we have two of the best defenses in the NBA going head-to-head in this matchup. Right now, I'm just checking NBA.com, advanced stats. The offensive rating for the Knicks is just unbelievably at 123 points every 100 possessions. But defense, the two best defenses in this postseason belong to the New York Knicks at 103.5 points allowed per 100 possessions, and the San Antonio Spurs at 104.4. So this is going to be, if you love defense, you're going to love this NBA Finals. And if you love high caliber guys who play two-way basketball, it's going to be hard to find a better matchup between two teams than the New York Knicks and the way they play both ends of the floor and the San Antonio Spurs. So this is, I'm excited, man. I haven't made my pick yet. I know before the postseason, I picked the Spurs to win it all. So probably not going to back off that pick, but whether it's going to be a 7-game series or a 6-game series, 5, I don't think it's going to be a sweep, but man, I cannot wait to dive in.
I can't wait either, Tom. It was a hell of a lot of fun to start to dive into it tonight with you, man. Always great to podcast with you as we have all season, Tom. And looking forward to doing it during the weeks ahead, during the NBA Finals, the NBA Draft, free agency, offseason, rumor mills about to heat up. Best time of the year, baby. Everybody check out Tom Havisham's podcast, The Big Number. You write on Yahoo Sports. You get Tom the Finder. You're everywhere on social media. Tom, thank you so much for joining me tonight, man.
You got it, Kev.
And thank you, everybody, for watching us live on YouTube. Please be sure to subscribe to Yahoo NBA if you have not done so already. Give this video a like if you enjoyed it. Please, that really does help us out. Thank you guys for watching us live. We'll be doing a hell of a lot here on Yahoo NBA during the NBA Finals and the lead up to the NBA Draft. So thank you guys for checking out. Thank you to Madison and Sarah for producing tonight's episode. Thank you, everybody, for watching us. Talk to you soon. Enjoy your weekend.